Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is television dialogue editor Don Murray. First of all, do you need a record label? In 2016, do you need a record label? There are so many ways that you could do it yourself these days that you have to wonder, is a record label even viable? Well, yes and no. But first of all, with all the resources out there, and there are plenty, and there are lots of people that will teach you how to do it, there are a lot of people that will teach you how to do social media, there are a lot of websites that are extremely helpful, there are blogs that will help you do just about whatever you want if you're an artist or a band. The big problem is you have to do the work. And let's face it, most musicians would rather just be musicians. They'd rather just be artists. They'd rather just write songs. They'd rather rehearse. They'd rather do anything but the hard marketing that really is involved when it comes to DIY. That being said, now is a great time to be in the business as an artist, just from the standpoint that you don't need a label to do so much anymore. You could easily record your own songs, and you don't need a label to bankroll you. Just about everybody has a home studio, has the software they need, has virtual instruments. If you have talent, you can certainly get it going. It's very easy to distribute your songs once you have them recorded, with aggregators like TuneCore and CD Baby and DistroKid. It's easy to get your works out there and available on any of the streaming networks. So that's not the hard part. The hard part is developing an audience. And of course, there's all sorts of resources out there to do that as well. So if you have the time and you have the inclination, you can actually do so much DIY. And in fact, we've seen this happen, and we've seen artists have been very successful doing it themselves. One that comes to mind is Macklemore and Ryan Lewis. And in fact, they've had tremendous success just doing it on their own. And even big hits. Number one on iTunes, that's all themselves. Number one on radio charts, all themselves. Number one albums on Billboard, they did it all themselves. Now, they've also exploited a new phenomena called label services, because the labels began to see that they had all of this infrastructure and excess capacity, so to speak. So the thought was, well, why don't we just rent this out? So now any artist, any DIY artist, can actually go to a record label and say, we will pay you just for your radio promotion. We will pay you just for your distribution. Anything that a record label has, you can buy from them. You can buy that service. This is called label services, and it's a brand new part of the business. The only problem is, of course, you need deep pockets. So at some point in time, you have to have some success in order to go to label services and actually make a deal with them. And in some cases, if you've had a lot of success, like Macklemore and Ryan Lewis, you can go and instead of actually putting cash down, you can just do a percentage. And that's what they did, in fact. They gave up a small piece of the records in order to get record promotion, in order to get distribution. So in fact, this is a brave new world here. But what it means is the fact that now you can do so much on your own without a record label. Now, when it comes to publishing, it's the same thing. It's a brave new world. Cobalt, for instance, Cobalt Music Publishing, is kind of leading the way in terms of how the publishing world now reacts to digital media. At one point in time, if you were a songwriter, you would have to wait at least a quarter, and sometimes 2 quarters, and even a year, to find out what your sales are for today. Now, the way it works is it used to take at least a quarter for all of the revenue sources to report back to the publisher, and then another quarter for the publisher to get that report out to you. And then for foreign sources, it would take far longer than that. Cobalt now has a brand new way of registering things that's very much 22nd century, in that now you could see in a dashboard online immediately when something happens. It happens in real time and it shows you, so you get your statements right away, which kind of revolutionizes the whole thing. And we're seeing more and more and more of that happening in record labels and in publishing as well. Now, there is one area, in fact, where you do need a record label, and that's once you become successful, if you really want to jump to the superstar level, the only way you can do it is with a record label because, in fact, they're the only ones that have the infrastructure for you to be able to do that. And as much as you would want to reinvent the wheel, it's just too expensive to do so. So that's the only time. But if you have that kind of success already, you're in pretty good shape to cut your own deal. So that's the new strategy for artists, in fact. Do it yourself as long as you can until you've had some success, and then you're in a better position because you have more power, and that's the time to go get a record deal. So do you need a label? No, you don't. And yes, you do. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget to check out my 101 Mixing Tricks program and my other online video courses on bobbyosinskycourses.com. You can also check out my music industry and music production blogs. Just go to bobbyosinsky.com to find the links where you can also read excerpts from my books. Now, I was doing a lot of listening recently to both a bunch of new songs and a bunch of old songs, and it dawned on me that production has changed a whole lot through the years. And in fact, I came up with 5 different ways that music production has changed from, let's say, the 60s, 70s, 80s to the way it is now. So, number one, first thing is, it's far less organic. When you listen to the hits of today, the top 20, so to speak, you find that most of them are built around beats and loops, where obviously that never happened way before. And that gives it a type of sound. It makes it more restricted because you're constricted by the loops and beats that you have. The second thing is, so much is quantized and on the grid. And of course, that was never possible back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and even 90s. And as a result, you had a looser type of more organic music. It felt better. Now everything is so on the grid that you have young editors that edit with their eyes rather than their ears. So what ends up happening is they automatically push things on the grid, whether that makes it sound better or not. So that's the second way that production has changed. The third way is effects layering is so much more sophisticated these days, and that's thanks to automation. It used to be that we only had fader and mute automation. That was it, and we were pretty happy with that. But now you can automate every single processor and every single effect. And as a result, what we get now is effects that happen or processing that happens just on a single word even, or a phrase, or even part of a word sometimes. And the end result of that is the fact that everything sounds very, very slick. So you get the slickness with all the automation, and that's, again, a big part of the sound today. The fourth thing is, most songs today have an ending. When you listen to most of the hits going back to the 50s, a great number of them were fade-outs. I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing, but that's completely changed. And one of the reasons why solid, hard endings are in vogue is it actually plays better in digital. So for instance, if you're listening to a stream and it begins to fade out, you're more than likely to change to something else rather than continue to listen. So for instance, if it's a radio station, an online radio station, you're more likely to switch on a fade than you are at the hard ending. So that's part of the reason. The other thing is it's kind of in vogue now too. And the last thing is music is very compressed as compared to the way it used to be. Now, it probably would have been compressed way back then if we had the same tools available. But nonetheless, everything is very, very compressed to within an inch of its life. Although that's beginning to change a little bit. Now that we have normalization that's happening in iTunes, normalization in Apple Music, normalization on Spotify, we're finding that if you have to compress something to within an inch of its life, it's probably not going to sound good under those conditions. So now everyone is beginning to learn to back off a little bit on the compression, and that's much, much for the better. So those are the 5 ways that production has changed, and just take notice. The next time you listen to the radio, for instance, listen to how many songs are built around beats. Listen to see if it's quantized or not, or how quantized it is. Listen to the effects layering, and listen to how slick it is, and is it a result of the automation? Listen for the ending. See if it's a hard ending or a fade. And also, try to listen and see how compressed it is. Those are the 5 things. My guest today is dialogue editor Don Murray, who's worked as an editor on network television shows for more than 20 years. I spoke with Don recently via phone from a studio in Burbank, California, where we discussed the unique job that an editor does. So maybe we can start there. Maybe you can just describe what you do.
Well, it's a little strange. I'll go from the process. The first thing we do is, if we do this in layers, is to track manage. So all of your effects tracks, anything that's recorded in production, that's an effect, a door close, maybe some footsteps, if they're decent, we split those off to a track. And then the next thing is the dialogue. And it's really, the dialogue gets split off to tracks based on the angle of the microphone. The take and the angle. Because behind each dialogue, each line, or each shot, I should say, is a specific sound of the room itself. And depending on where you are in the room, it sounds different. So we go through, and every single angle we assign a track to, and we move the dialogue to the specific tracks. Sometimes it's a boom mic, which you may have more than one character on it. So the boom mics get split as a sound within themselves, because you're going to have the same ambience between the two characters. Then, gets a little more difficult, because sometimes you use body mics. And yeah, Depending on how the body mics sound, you're going to split those off into different tracks, either based on the sound that's behind the dialogue or character. If it's a really close body mic and you hear no room ambience, then you can probably do it by character. And the idea is to think about how it's going to be presented to a mixer, because different angles, different sounds are going to be processed differently by the mixer. So sometimes it's different characters, same body mic, sound, and you really kind of need to think about everything beyond what you're doing as an editor. So when it gets to a stage, everything's pretty efficient. The other thing we do is split off things for telephone conversation, TV, and those kinds of things get split off into separate tracks.
That seems like you'd have an awful lot of tracks then. How many do you get in, and then how many wind up being sent out?
Oh, right. Okay. So let's say a typical show will easily run you sets of tracks, probably six, eight. If it's like a boom, you get a boom and 6 to 8 body mics, if it's mic'd that way. Let's say we're going to go crazy. And then on top of that, that will get split even further by shot into another set of 6 or 8 tracks. And as you go through the show, you're going to listen to every single body mic and every single boom mic and split the show off based on what they sound like and what's going to work best for a scene. I guess one of the hard things to realize or explain is when you're listening to dialogue, you're cutting dialogue, you're not really listening to the dialogue itself. You're listening to everything else behind it. So if you're mixing a music track and taking out the vocals. So, and everything else that isn't vocal isn't really music. It's just room sound.
Yeah.
So you're smoothing out all the different room sounds for each angle. And then once that's all laid out, you're going to start removing every single noise, syllable, whatever that's bad from the track. So ticks, footstep, anything that gets in the way of dialogue gets pulled out.
Pulled out meaning you delete it?
If it's footsteps and you think it can be used, it'll be put on an effects track, mm-hmm. production effects track. if it's like maybe a hand slap or somebody drops something on the set, it's going to get deleted. And then you're going to go find some ambience from the room, and stick that in that spot. And the whole idea is to build a track that it represents the show from beginning to end. And there's nothing else but dialogue that you can work with, or effects that, you know, that can be processed or used or added in if needed.
How often are those effects tracks that you cleave off of the main track, of the dialogue track, how often are they used as compared to, you know, being replaced?
The big shows, they replace everything. Other shows, you can't really assume that everything's going to be replaced. If you think it's usable, and part of it is you don't know what the director, producer, whoever is on the stage says, you know, I liked what I heard in the original track, and you cut that back in. It's got to be there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of on a whim. I mean, many times, you know, you can cut in stuff that's much nicer from you know, effects editor's point of view. But if the producer wants what he heard on the set, that's what's going to go in.
Okay, so
it kind of all has to be there.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I know you've talked a lot to me in the past about cleaning things up, and you were using Isotope a lot.
Right. Right. You know, that's kind of a weird area because, you know, in years past, we didn't have that, and that was something that mixers did on the stage. Maybe not so much taking out something dropped on the set, but maybe cloth noise, something like that, was pulled out by the mixer. And it's sort of getting laid on to dialogue editors now. So it's a bit different, and it's kind of weird because sometimes you clean something out, it doesn't sound right, and either you dig out an alternate take, cut it in, or you give the original to the mixer on top of it, you know, on another track.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe muted, maybe not, so that they can go back to it and do whatever they think they can do.
In a way, I'm glad to hear you say that, because every time I use Isotope, I shouldn't say every time, many times when I use it, and I'll listen back and I'll go, that just doesn't sound right. Maybe I'm not using this right, or I don't know how to use this correctly. So it's kind of good to know that it happens to you guys that use it all the time.
Well, yeah, it's also sometimes it just doesn't work. It's not so much you clean something up, right? And you're listening to the line before it and the line after it, and it just doesn't work right.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you leave it. And for me, it depends on how much I do to it. If I do a lot of stuff to it, you know, I'll leave them what we call a next track, where you just put stuff down there and we're not using that, but here it is if you need it. And right now the shows I'm working on, I run with two X tracks, so I can at least do two different angles, but I'm cleaning lots of stuff up. The most difficult stuff is when there's when you're doing an exterior and you're trying to get rid of, you know, traffic and wind noise and airplanes and stuff like that it will take over the whole track. You got to really pay attention to the frequencies you're dealing with and just be aware that it may not work.
Wow. I mean, that's tough, because you get rid of some of that stuff and you get rid of the dialogue as well.
Right. Well, there's the other thing is, you know, as I've gotten shows that are fairly clean sometimes, and you start cleaning stuff up and then all this other stuff, all this other noise that you didn't hear before because you took away the ambient noise, the wind or whatever, all that other stuff starts showing up.
Mm, yeah.
And so you begin to just strip off layers and layers and layers of sound until you have really clean dialogue. And it can be, a show can be too recorded too clean and not clean enough.
Well, okay, let's go there. What do you mean too clean?
If you're working on a show that shot on a set, right? A lot of stuff we do, you know, the stuff that's hard to clean is, you know, low budget and shot on location. But you start to shoot stuff like in a set with a room and there's a, let me see if I can give you an example. Okay, two people are walking along, right? And there's like footsteps and tiny little footsteps and things underneath it, right? And you clean that away. Okay. Now they're walking along and the cloth movement, let's say from their pants or something, sticks out. So now that's in the way. Now you're cleaning that out. And you start stripping off layers and layers and layers of stuff until you've got dialogue. Now you can do that forever, and part of what cutting dialogue is determining how far you're going to go. You kind of have to listen to if it's one angle, if everything's really quiet and the dialogue sounds great and you cut to one angle and there's all this cloth movement, then you have a problem. Now, do you add it in to the lines before and after, or do you try to remove it? Do you find an alternate take? Do you have them come back in and reread their lines?
Who is it up to do that, to do ADR? You say, look, I've tried everything on this and I just can't get it any better. And then it either goes on or they come back and do it.
In a perfect world, the supervisor would say in a spotting session, we may need to get this guy in. And a lot of times in their contract, it may be that the character has to come in and do their ADR for, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. But as a dialogue editor, everybody hates to use the ADR because it never fits.
Yeah.
I think maybe there's one or two people that I've worked with where they could reread their lines perfectly and it wouldn't just match up. And so you never get the performance because you don't have the set, they don't have everyone else around them, and they've lost the character. So sometimes they try to ADR maybe just a couple words of the line, which to me it's just so obvious when they do that. So the dialogue editor's got to go dig through alternate takes and see if you can find something that'll work. If it's just, you know, a couple words or a sentence, might be able to get through it. If it's an entire scene, well, you know, sometimes you just got to bring everybody in and do it and suffer with it. Shooting on the top of a rooftop of a building with a helicopter going, you know, that kind of thing, everyone's got to come in and do the line, and they should know that before they even mix the show, before they even cut it.
Do you get the ADR along with the live tracks as well, or does that come in later?
No. In fact, we don't know if ADR is even going to be done. So dialogue editors assume that we're cutting the show. I do anyway. I'm cutting the entire show. And then if ADR is going to be used, I'll prep where the lines are for that. And that's the same thing. That's taking the room tone and putting the room tone in that matches the good takes before and after it, so that the ADR doesn't stick out like a, you know, like it was recorded in the studio.
Yeah, right. Can you describe the tools, the typical tools that you use?
Well, the Pro Tools pencil is pretty popular. That's probably where I used a lot of stuff. But now that Isotope is there, there's a lot of stuff is available on that too. You know, the declicker takes a lot of stuff out. What else? The denoisers. All the denoisers work. I also use the program called Revoice Pro, which will match lines. You sample a line, and then you can, if you take an alternate take, you can actually load that in, and it'll line it up.
Mm-hmm.
What do you call it? Peaks. You know, it takes all the peaks, matches them up on the waveform.
Yeah.
And it'll also match the energy and pitch if you want it to.
Wow.
So I use that when I'm really in a bind and I'm having difficulty making something match, I'll pull that out. But usually I can get stuff to work without it. And it's really, a lot of it is watching the lips of someone and what's going to work and not be noticed when it goes by, looking for certain syllables and things like that. But
yeah, so it's based on your experience, really, when it's all said and done.
Oh, yeah. It's hours and hours of, you know, it's the hardest thing. Probably it takes probably a couple of years just to get through not listening to what somebody says. And you still do it because you just can't. But then it's like, I'm almost to a point now where it's hard for me to have conversations because I'm always listening to everything else but conversation. Kind of weird.
Well, no, I understand completely because it's the same thing with music. You know, you get to analyzing what's in a production, and after a while, you kind of lose yourself, and you don't listen to the song anymore. You're listening to the production. You're listening through the recording. So I understand completely how that could work. Same thing.
Right. Oh, along with the obsession of, you know, this syllable isn't right. And then, really, who's going to know?
Yeah, yeah.
So,
well, how long does it take you to do a show?
The average is about an hour a minute of showtime. It takes an hour to cut about a minute of showtime.
Okay.
And that's, you know, that's just an average. It can get worse. I mean, you have scenes that are worse and scenes that are, you know, easy to cut. So sometimes, you know, I have spent 3 days on a minute one time.
Wow.
On the show that was just, it was a bear. But, you know, that was a lot of work to get the character, you know, the actor back in and had to get it done.
Okay. Give me the best and the worst case then. What would be the best case for you when you get something in, you go, wow, this is magic. This is great. Very easy.
Oh man, the easiest thing I did, I didn't have to do anything. I mean, there was like, I would just basically smooth out the background noise, which was next to nothing, and maybe one or two lines to fix. And I was like a 28-minute show or something like that. And yeah, that was it. And I was getting paid 3 days to work for it, so it was fine with me. it was practically real time. I mean, I did a lot of stuff that just really, I was wondering why I was doing it at all, but, you know, that's what they expected, so.
Yeah. Okay.
Worst case scenario, is low budget. Guys are off mic. There's no body mics. You know, the mic is in this separate room. There's footsteps all over it. You're pulling all those out. You got birds and crickets going through it, and an airplane by, and anything. I mean, it's just,
yeah,
anything you can imagine can happen. I mean, you know, some of the easier stuff is you might have, let's say, you're shooting a scene and people are walking down the sidewalk. And so you've got one angle where the mic is facing the person close to a building. And then you got another angle where the other person is closer to the street. And so you're going back and forth. So one side's got all the traffic. The other side's got no traffic because it's, you know, bouncing off the building. Pretty
yeah.
Much.
Wow.
So, you know, all that has to get smoothed out. Those are, you know, that's a typical everyday sort of thing that you deal with.
Wow. I could imagine that would be, that would make me crazy going through that.
Or you're shooting a scene. This was one where you're shooting a scene and it's a night scene and they start with 6-7 o'clock at night and you're shooting the scene and as the night goes on, crickets.
Oh yeah.
Crickets come up. Okay. So now they're cutting, you know, the later angle from the earlier angle, one's got crickets, the other one doesn't. You know, then that's the kind of thing that you can probably pull some of that out with isotope, but also they'll just add crickets in with the effects track to help it out. Or a rain scene. It's, you know, they're doing a take, it's raining, and the next take it's not. You know, nothing they can do about it, but either add rain in or ADR the characters.
Yeah, yeah, right. Wow. Okay, how did you get into dialogue editing? This isn't something that most people aspire to that I'm aware of, right?
You know what? There are people that do.
Really?
I think part of it is a person that has the ears for it. You know, I was working and they kind of ran out of work and said, hey, you want to cut dialogue? And I went, what's that? And just said, okay, I'll go for it. And I did it, you know. And it took a while. I mean, it took a few years to really be able to cut like anything. But as you know, I started with tape, doing it on tape.
Yeah.
And then managed to learn 3 different workstations in the process. So, you know, that became, do I want to learn the next workstation? No, but, you know, it's a gig.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, okay.
But, you know, part of it is, you know, my listening abilities have been always been a little different than other people. So, you know, even with working with music, I tend to not listen to, you know, the main voice, the main thing going on, and spend more time listening to everything else behind that. So that was helpful.
Yeah, right. I could see how. Definitely. Okay. Well, let's go back to the tape days then. How did you do it on tape?
The process is all the same, except for, rather than dragging something to a track, you would put up a quarter inch tape. Well, no, in the later days, we used synchronizers, and we put up a quarter inch tape, and then it would, I forgot. It's been so long.
That's probably a good thing.
We would take their guide track, and we would split that off. And then to extend anything, we would grab the quarter inch tape of the angle, and we would either, find room tone from that and loop it through, or do fade ins and fade outs, or we would cut in, a word or a syllable or a line from the quarter inch tape. And just do a record in, record out, and move on.
It sounds like a horrible process.
Yeah. Digital made that so much easier, I'll tell you.
Okay, so you said you went through three different DAWs, and I know that the one you're on now is Pro Tools. What were the other two?
The other was Sonic Solutions, early days.
Huh?
And then Doremi. Dawn.
Oh, yes.
If they're gone. Well, Dolby bought them, actually. So.
Yeah, I remember that. Okay. Let's talk about the business then for a little bit. How has that changed? Because I know we've had these conversations through the years, and you had expressed to me how things were different than they previously were. So can you explain the changes in the business?
One of the things that I'm not sure if this is so much the business, but and a different attitude about cutting and doing things. And in the early days, as you would hang out, you'd learn what you could and work your way up through the system. And one of the main things was that, a picture editor would take time and care. Let's say back in the film days, right?
Mm-hmm.
You would cut your picture and it would be right. I mean, you'd have a work track and someone would cut the film. It would be right and they would send it on to the next person. Well, now it's, they'll send you picture and say, well, this isn't right. We're going to send you a new version, or just not really be careful about, is all the dialogue there, or is it on the dialogue tracks, or is the dialogue showing up on effects tracks? And there's less care about what they're handing on to the next guy because, they can fix it. Well, yeah, you can, but it takes away from your time of actually doing what you need to do. So it's kind of, here it is, you deal with it attitude versus I'm handing you what you need and thanks.
Yeah.
That part of it. The other parts, I think I mentioned earlier, that dialogue editors are doing a lot more of the work that mixers used to do. So that's probably one of the biggest differences.
Well,
that's pretty much it.
Well, the other thing too is now most of you guys are independent contractors, where before you used to work for a company, right?
Yes and no. I do work for a company, but I work at home. I work for a smaller company, so there's actually a different union deal for the smaller post-production facilities as opposed to Disney, Warner Brothers, Fox mm-hmm. or Sony or whatever. They will have people on the lot doing their cutting. But the smaller guys now, the trend is to, have people cut at home because they don't have to pay for the real estate. They don't have to pay for the systems. So it becomes more cost efficient for them to work that way. And, from my point of view, the hours are fine. I make my own hours as long as I get the show cut before it mixes. And I get paid, and I do.
Yeah, right. Well, of course, you have to buy your own rig, but that's not a huge expense these days.
It isn't, and most guys have their own anyway. I mean, you know, even if it's just to learn on it, you know. So one of the tricky things is if guys don't set their system up properly or have a very good one, and they're missing stuff. They're not cleaning stuff up, and I mean, it is important to be able to hear what you're cutting properly. And there are guys that cut, you know, I haven't done this yet because I'm 99% sure that it would drive me nuts, but there are guys that cut on headphones.
Wow.
I that would just kill my ears, but I may try it just to hear things differently.
Well, I understand that you can probably hear minute things that you wouldn't hear otherwise. Because, I mean, there's always clicks and pops and things like that that show up on phones that, you know, you wouldn't hear on speakers. So I can understand that. Or are they using something like Waves NX or something, you know, an artificial room simulator, or just listening straight ahead?
They're using some of that stuff, I think, on the stage, but not as an editor. As an editor, that's where you draw the line. You know, unless you really think you can, some of the guys may use it for ADR cutting, but for the most part, no. You're trying to give them the cleanest track they possibly can have for mixing, and anything else needs to be matched because that gets into, you know, well, what's the effects track doing? And you kind of have to have all that to make it work. Plus, you know, are they EQing something? Is it going to work with that? You know, dialogue editors don't tend to EQ very much. Not even for telephone or anything like that. You know, one of the things I did want to mention is, you know, we talk about tape. One of the things cutting with tape is there was a lot of stuff that just never recorded. Pops and ticks and things that now show up in digital that you got to deal with. So it's a different, it's a little different process, but.
Tell me about file transfer. So what's the file like that you get? How big is it? And then what do you deliver and how do you deliver it?
Interesting. The file can be, decided on by the studio, but I'm cutting on a broadcast wave. So, and
is it one file with a lot of tracks embedded then? Or is it multiple tracks?
Well, with the picture, okay, I get a guide track. And the guide track is from beginning to end exactly what the picture editor cut. Okay, and that's just a guide. And then I get the, on a drive, they have downloaded all the takes for the entire show. And that gets assembled by an assistant editor. And sunk up to the guide track in the picture that was delivered. It could be 8 tracks wide. It could be 24 tracks wide. It could be whatever, but it's based on whatever the picture editor cut. I get that and then start going through and managing tracks from there.
So you're getting a Pro Tools session?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
Yeah. They spit out an AAF?
They
spit out an AAF, and then we assemble from that, we assemble the dialogue from the DVDs or whatever they recorded from.
Is it AAF or OMF?
It used to be OMF. It's AAF now.
Okay.
And it's actually a little cleaner than the OMF. It's a nicer track.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then...
But it's basically the same process, the same thing.
Yeah. Okay, so then you do your thing, and then how do you deliver it? So are you getting a drive then, or are you just getting it online?
No, I pick up a whole drive, and it is... Let me look here. Let's see, the last thing I got was... Yeah, 70 gig.
Okay.
I think files I got for this show was Yeah, 57 gig. That's just the raw material.
Okay.
Well, that's not including picture.
Ah, okay. So where is the picture on the drive too? Must be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I go over, pick up a drive, and it has picture and all the dailies that were shot.
So do you deliver the same drive back?
No. What I do is a little different situation. You ever use Compact in Pro Tools? I save my session to a separate drive.
Okay.
And just for safety reasons, I delete or I eject the drive that I was cutting on. And then you open up your file, and it has all of the tracks and all of, the complete tracks of all the takes and the cut show. And if you select all files and tell it to compact it, it only gives you the material plus up to, I think, 3 seconds on either side of it. It deletes all the other material. And then I do a save session of that session and compact it, or what do you call it, zip it down.
Uh-huh.
And I end up with a file that is, 776 megabytes. And then I send that up to a server.
700 megabytes? Okay.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so you started with, you said it was like 50-some megabytes, 50-some, and it's winding up to be 770?
Oh, well,
yeah,
remember.
Yeah, you're splitting off tracks and stuff. Okay, yeah. I see. Okay.
Well, I'm also not, there's probably tracks that I'm not even using.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So they're probably takes that are no good, or takes where they just left the mic on for an hour. Which is very common now that they're not paying for tape.
Yeah, I bet. Wow.
I spit that out to a server, and they pull that off wherever the stage is. They download that and fire it up, and they're good to go.
Yeah.
I would assume, I know probably at the big lots, they just hand over a drive and, they load it up and go from there. So, but since I'm working at home and, logistics becomes a problem, I can, 3 a.m, send a file to a server and it's on the stage the next day.
Yeah, but boy, if it's 700 gigabytes that you're sending, wow, it's going to take a lot of time to upload.
No. Megabytes.
Oh, megabytes. Oh, that, big difference there. Yeah, okay, right. Okay.
Yeah. It's 776 megabytes, and we started with 60 gig.
Yeah, I see. Okay. Now that makes sense to me.
Yeah. I did it wrong the first time. I didn't know about all this, and I was sending it up, and it was taking like 15 hours. And I was running on an AT&T line. I'm like, if something goes wrong, it's not going to make it to the stage. So I ended up driving the drive to the stage that day because I knew I could drive it there faster than this could upload. But when I figured out the rest of this process, it takes about maybe 2 hours. It depends on how fast the server is running.
I remember you telling me about that.
You do it in off hours.
Yeah, I remember you telling me about that, actually. I've never used Compact. I didn't realize. So what that'll do, that'll throw out all the stuff you're not using then, right?
Yeah. The thing about it is, you'll get all the warnings from Pro Tools, but the thing about it is you can't go back, which means, do it on a separate drive. Do it, make sure your original material is off somewhere, and you can use it and delete what you don't need. And just the files that you need get sent up for the final session.
Yeah.
And when you're done, open up the session and make sure that it all links up. Also, one of the tricks about it is when you make your original session when you make your first session before you compact it, make sure you delete unused from your session. There's a clear unused from the bin.
Mm-hmm.
And then it won't save that stuff over. Otherwise, it'll save the unused material that you.
Yeah, it defeats
it'll save the unused material, and since it's in the bin, when you do the compact, it'll save those files as well.
Yeah, it defeats the purpose then of doing the compact then.
Right.
Yeah, I get it. Okay, last question. This is something I ask of everybody, and I'm sure you're going to have a different take because you're coming from a different part of the industry, but what is the best piece of advice that you received from somebody or you learned along the way when it comes to the entertainment business, the music business, the television business?
You know, I think one of the best things someone told me, and I can only say from as a dialogue editor, was that this show has to work. I mean, if there's no music and there's no effects, tracks, you need to play your show through and watch it down. And it needs to be like it's going on air that way. Mm-hmm. And it just needs to work. If there's, you know, if something drops out or something sounds weird, it's not right.
Yeah.
And it made my job, I look at my job completely differently that way.
Yeah, I can see how.
Because it's weird. I'm not so much involved in the business end, other than because most of the business part is dealt with by the union. So it's kind of a different answer than you'd expect, I guess.
No, but it's equally as valid because it's all about what you do. So
yeah,
and essentially that's what I was looking for. How does is there a big piece of advice about what you do that's important? And there is. That's a good thing.
Well, and the other thing, and I guess probably everybody should get this advice, and maybe people don't, but my job isn't about what I do. It's about what the next guy gets from me and how he has to deal with what I do. In other words, I really do think about, if I was mixing this show, what would I expect?
Mm-hmm.
And then I cut that way and I deliver it that way, because I think that's one of the things that makes you successful in this. If you think a mixer is going to, might need something, you cut something in, you go, oh, it might not be right. Here's another one. Here's another way I did it, and send it off to him. And you might mute it on the track, but he has it on the stage. So it's going beyond what, Here, they'll deal with it on the stage. That attitude it doesn't work in this business.
Thanks for listening and being my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, or Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.